Hey everybody, what's going on? Welcome back to Overserved. This is Ari Bendersky.
And Maggie Hennessy.
And we are here to talk about what life is like in Chicago and its culinary world. Once again. And, you know, so as Maggie and I do, we like to talk about things that have happened in the week prior. And like every episode, we have somebody special joining us. And this week, we have the esteemed Eric Williams. He is the chef owner of Virtue Restaurant in Hyde Park. And we will be chatting with him in a little bit. But first off, Maggie, what do you want to talk about this week?
Well, first, I would like to know what your favorite thing is that you ate in the past week.
You know, it's interesting. It wasn't my favorite thing that I ate last night, but is one of my favorite things in Chicago, period, mm-hmm. is the chicken thigh skewers with the smashed potatoes that they have at the Purple Pig. And, I recently went to the, grand reopening party of the Purple Pig. They moved their location from across the street, still on Michigan Avenue on the other side of Illinois. And it basically looks exactly the same. It looks like it's just now like three times bigger. Anyway, they at this party, they were passing around the chicken thigh. It wasn't the best because, you know, when you do big parties, it's not always optimal.
So not a great representation of your favorite thing you should have been eating in the past week.
Totally. But it is. I mean, yeah. if you've never had it, I totally recommend going and sitting at the chef's counter and getting this dish amongst other things. But yeah, that's one of my favorite things in the city.
Lovely.
What did you eat?
My favorite thing that I ate in the past week was a thing I made, which felt real good, but it was from a chef. So the chef owner of Elski in the West Loop.
I think it's Elska.
Elska. Thank you.
It's Danish. It means Danish. Love.
Elska. Love. Which I do love that place.
Me too. And fun fact, if I can plug my friend, one of my dearest friends, Aaron Boone of Boone Interiors, designed that restaurant.
It's a beautiful
and it
space.
It is gorgeous. It and does. It's so warm and welcoming and comfortable.
Serene. If you will. Yeah. So I do a column for Chicago Magazine every month called In the Kitchen.
Yes, you do.
Where I test and then write about and write up a recipe from chefs around the city. This one he sent me was for an omelet in a bag. It's lovely. You park hook eggs with cream cheese, just like you would scramble into a soft scramble to a custard. And then you put it into a Ziploc bag, roll it in a taquito shape, and then you boil it for about 3 minutes.
Really?
And it's, if you're a fan of the custardy.
Yeah.
With like just a barely a little encasing on the outside. Mm. It's a very French style kind of omelet.
Real,
custardy inside. Luscious. It was beautiful. And because what I love about getting recipes from chefs is they teach you finessey things that you wouldn't do on your own, which includes making brown butter and then drizzling it over the said omelet along with a little bit of squirt of lemon. Chive. I was in heaven.
Was anything inside said omelet?
Just the egg and cream cheese mixture. I mean, you could add probably more herbs if you wanted. There was a little touch of cayenne and salt, but very simple. But you could for sure. You'd have to think about things, though, that would stand up okay to boiling. So if you did like soft herbs, they might discolor and it wouldn't look so good. So I actually kind of loved the simplicity. But you could add probably a different melty cheese if you wanted. Oh, maybe a little. I wonder how meat would go in there. I don't know.
What was the sound that you made when you first took a bite?
I mean, to be honest with you, the thing that excited me the most was rolling this thing out of the bag.
That was going to ask
the
you.
Plate,
like, but how does that work though? Like, I mean, are you rolling it up? Is the plastic kind of like the Ziploc? Is it kind of like wound up within the
egg? Yeah, it's like do you know what a taquito is?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's like the taco shell, but it's the bag. So you roll it up, you secure it with scotch tape, and you drop it in boiling water, give it a couple minutes, take it out, wait just a few seconds, or use your hands that are already almost have
calluses.
Calloused anyway, which mine are. And then you unroll it and sort of let it fall onto the plate. And it was like, I think I made that sound when it happened. Oh. And then when you cut into it, it just kind of, it's beautiful. It's a eggs are magical.
Okay. Recently, it was Bourdain Day.
Mm-hmm. That was actually my birthday also, June 25th.
It was your birthday.
And his birthday, yeah. We share the same birthday. I didn't know that until this year.
so basically, do you want to talk about what it was?
Bourdain Day was started by his friends, Chef Jose Andres, Eric Repair. It was essentially asking for a worldwide toast on social to Bourdain and kind of the way he lived his life.
And just to back up for anybody who's listening, if you don't know who Anthony Bourdain was mm-hmm. or what happened to him, he was one of the most celebrated culinary characters in the world in the last 5 or 10 years. He was a chef. He wrote Kitchen Confidential, kind of exposing the underbelly of working in kitchens. And then he became a celebrity,
a TV personality,
mm-hmm. and he would travel around the world. And last year, last June, he killed himself.
Mm-hmm. He was filming in France and
committed suicide. So this was basically a year later.
I think he was 63.
Was he that old?
Oh no, he would have been 63. I think he was 61 when he, committed suicide.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. I didn't realize he was that old. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah. So there was how did you celebrate it?
Well, I went to the Cubs game because I turned 35.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And, but I think ideally, you know, I would have been able to, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I did, because I think he really, what he encouraged was this spirit of, encouraging people to get outside of their comfort zones, travel, learn from it, be uncomfortable where necessary, expand their horizons and understand that there are perspectives different from their own. And I think the way he did that and the way we watched him sort of almost evolve to that place through, because at the beginning when he was on TV, and when he was a chef there, he admitted later that he was much a part of that sort of macho culture, hard drinking and drug use, staying, you know, and sort of yelling, adapting like that's a certain persona of a chef, that swagger. But then through travel he became more of a political figure in a way, through learning, you know, about other cultures, spending time breaking bread with people who look different from him. And so I think in a way he showed us that you can learn no matter what age you are, and that travel is a huge part of kind of opening your eyes and just seeing different perspectives. And I think we've talked about this in the past, just even thinking about your own city that way, you know,
I was just going to say that.
Yeah. Just exploring places that are outside your comfort zone, even in a small way.
Yeah.
And cuisine is a great way to do that, because no matter what you're eating, there are elements that you can find relation to. I just reviewed a few weeks ago Cebu, which is a Filipino restaurant in Wicker Park.
Three siblings started it.
Yep. And the amazing thing is these dishes I was eating, chicken in a sal, which is basically a barbecue chicken thigh, and it's coated in this sticky, sweet, very vinegary sauce. Mm. Reminded me of when I was a kid and my dad would take a whole bottle of Sweet Baby Ray's and put it over chicken thighs and cook them on the grill.
Yeah.
And in an aluminum pan. And there were these, it was sweet. There was a little tart, you know, tartness. Mm-hmm. And so it took me back. And I don't know, you know, I've never been to Cebu. It's like one of the provinces in the Philippines.
Right.
And so I think that's where he sort of stumbled on this. It started with food, but then it got bigger, I think. And that tends to happen when I think with a lot of things, if you just spend enough time, it's hard not to start to go, wait, there's something bigger going on here.
Right. And it also just, it forces us to look beyond our comfort zones, to get out there, to experience what other people are seeing, eating, talking about, et cetera. And when you come together with people over food, you're breaking bread, and that's where our boundaries break down and our fences fall, and we can come together over food. No matter what your background is, where you're from, what you believe in, when you come together and you sit down at a table, it knocks things down. And I think that's actually a really great transition to introduce our guest today.
Ooh, yes, it is.
Chef Eric Williams. And I say that that's a great transition because a number of years ago, when Eric was the executive chef of MK Restaurant, which is sadly no longer, he had a group of kids from Lawndale and from Englewood, which never come together. And for many reasons, a lot of which are gang related. And Eric brought a group of kids together into the kitchen to cook at MK. And by the end, they were all smiling together, laughing together, eating together. And he told me the story with such pride in his face, saying that, like, this is how you bring people together. This is how you cross the lines without crossing lines. Mm-hmm. So that being said, Eric Williams, thank you so much for joining us today on Overserved.
Thank you for having me.
How are you feeling?
I feel great.
So hearing me talk about that that story, what does that bring up for you?
Warm thoughts. when I think about the idea of challenging the norm and using techniques that have been implemented for, you know, centuries, and the idea of bringing people together around food and purpose, it really warms my heart.
What was a big takeaway from that day? And did you hear from any of those kids after the fact about what it meant to them?
Interestingly enough, we have not backtracked to find out what it meant to the individual kids. We have seen the impact because I have continued that work, and not always with high school level kids. We've kind of expanded it into adulthood, and one could argue that that is kind of the catalyst for the restaurant.
Okay. The restaurant being Virtue.
Yes.
So for anybody just joining us right now, Eric Williams is our guest. He is the chef owner of Virtue Restaurant in Hyde Park, which is, if you have not been, I encourage you to go immediately. Even if you don't live in Chicago, come here and go there. It is one of the best new restaurants in the city. It is Eric's take on Southern food.
Yes.
Or soul food, more Southern.
Yeah.
And we're going to get into that in a little bit, but talk about when and how did you start working in restaurants? How did you come to that point?
I started working in restaurants many years ago, and I don't ever think about the exact date, but let's just say it's a little shy of 3 decades.
Okay. And where, how did you get in?
I started working at a place by the name of Solar Bar and Grill. Just south of Grand Avenue. And it was solely a means to an end. I had no aspirations to be a chef. I worked there for a short stint, and then...
Were you cooking?
Yes, yeah. Yes. I was cooking. It was short order cooking. It was nothing fine at all. And I was walking past a place called the Hudson Club, which was a block north of the space.
And this is in River North, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was a young kid with headphones on. I had just got off the bus, and I walked past a guy sweeping. I'm surprised I've never shared the story with you. I was walking past a guy sweeping, and I looked at the guy, and a voice in my head said, ask that guy if they're hiring. And I looked at him, and I was like, this guy is sweeping. Like, what does he know about me getting a job? And so I take a few more steps, and I hear this voice again, and it says, ask that guy if they're hiring. And I look back at the guy and had the same response. And I got to the corner, and I heard the voice the third time, and I turned around. Without
the voice
thinking,
said, dummy, go back. Yeah. Listen to me.
And I asked the guy if they were hiring, and he stopped doing what he was doing and went inside and got his chef, who was Paul Larson at the time. And Paul came out, met with me, interviewed me the next day, asked me what I was doing outside of my day-to-day, and I told him I was working down the street and I wanted to work two jobs. And he said, well, we're in the midst of an opening, and it's going to be a lot more demanding than you're expecting, and so we need you to have one job. So if anything changes in the near future, please get back to us. We'd love to bring you on. And I got laid off at the end of that week.
Wow. What did you do to get you laid off?
Nothing. They were like cutting.
Okay.
Like restaurants do.
Yeah.
You were made redundant.
Yeah. Immediately. Yeah. And so I politely walked back up the street, right, at the end of the beginning of the following week, and says, hey guys, some things have changed. And they said, great, what? And I said, well, I'm no longer working down the street. And they said, awesome. And they hired me immediately. I never missed a check. No. interview with Michael Cornick, which was the longest interview of my life.
Well, because Michael likes to talk, yeah, as we all know.
Yes, he is not shy. But interestingly enough, he talked to me for an hour about basketball only.
Yeah, I remember this conversation.
Yeah. So he wanted to help me understand, as a young, unlearned cook, that if I had decent hand and eye coordination, and if I understood the parallels of being on offense one moment and then losing the ball and having to quickly get back on defense to recover, that he would be able to teach me how to cook and the importance, not just the skill of cooking, but the importance of satisfying customers on a day-to-day basis. And he was right.
And you actually started working at MK right when it opened, correct?
Yes, I was at MK pre-opening, and I started as a salad cook.
And MK was open for how many years?
Someone told me 19 the other day. I think it was 18. I don't know. 18, 19 years. Shy of 20 years.
But the thing that was really cool about MK was that here was Cornick, who had worked. Did he work at Trotter's? No.
No, he did not. Actually, he and Trotter worked in the same space. He was the chef at Gordon's, if I'm not mistaken. And Trotter was maybe a back waiter or a busser way back then. Like, he wasn't even in the back of the house. It's an interesting story.
But MK opened up in a location that was on Franklin Street, that was just north of Chicago Avenue, in an area that most people at that time would not have ventured to go. And Michael had foresight and opened this, what became one of the city's best restaurants. And you have people like Mindy Siegel, who worked there, Todd Stein worked there. And it became one of the most celebrated fine dining restaurants. And the thing that I think is the best part of the story in relation to you is that you started out as a salad prep guy that you just mentioned, and you eventually worked your way up to the executive chef, oversaw the kitchen, mentored younger chefs, proudly walked out into the dining room with your chef's coat on to greet tables all the time, and you were the executive chef until the restaurant closed. And I think that that's an incredible thing for somebody who didn't have classical training, didn't go to culinary school, got a job by walking up the street, talking to a guy sweeping the sidewalk.
Yeah.
And now you have your own restaurant in Hyde Park.
Absolutely.
When did you, because you said initially you didn't have really, it was a means to an end. When for you did it become something more? Was it at MK?
You know, there's no specific date. Yeah. Yes, it was at MK. Yeah. I was studying real estate many years ago, and I was only working in kitchens to be employed and work my way through my studies and become a broker. And so, interestingly enough, the broker's exam, I don't know what time of year it is now, but it happens right around September to November during this period in my life. And that's right around the time, somewhere between September and November. And that's right around the time when restaurants start ramping up. Mm-hmm. So every year, right before it was time for me to take the exam, I would get like all the hours I could possibly ask for, because that's the season. Yeah. So I would just be incredibly swamped. And
restaurant yanked you back.
Yes. I like to just say to people that, you know, I worked for a guy who was so passionate about food, it became infectious.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't genuinely my aspiration.
That's powerful.
Well, it's the truth. I mean, I remember walking in the restaurant over a period of, you know, some time, and things just started looking different. You know, I would pick up books and the food looked the same books I already owned. The food seemed like it jumped out of the page versus being on the page at some point. Yeah. And I became a lot more intrigued and a lot more involved and a lot more engaged. And that was, those were the first steps to me really launching forward and becoming a chef.
So how did virtue start to form in your mind, and when did you decide you were going to do this sort of broad spectrum Southern restaurant?
You know, I don't know when virtue started forming in my mind. Virtue really took a shape of its own. And sitting in the restaurant, it feels very natural. Like this is like some very elaborate and thought out process, but it's really a lot of processes that were really in sitting in their own space that came together in one space. And it happened to be that restaurant that sits on the corner. And so a few things happened. When MK closed, I made sure that there was placement for all of my teammates that worked in the restaurant that chose to stay in the industry and chose to accept my help.
And what year did MK close?
Oh boy.
2017, wasn't it? Think.
It was that recent.
2017,
yeah.
Sounds right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And so there were these check-ins, right? Because I was very accustomed to talking to our team and we actually cared about each other, right? Which is unheard of these days, right? Yeah. To actually care about somebody.
What are you
with.
Talking about?
Yeah. And so there would be these weekly check-ins. Either I would be calling someone or they would be calling me, and we would drill down on everything from like what specials they were putting out at a restaurant to how to deal with a managerial issue to how to leverage better pay, what the expectation should be after they receive better pay. So it was almost like I was still managing, but I was outside of a restaurant. And everything came up in these conversations. If someone was behind on their rent, if someone got a raise, whatever you could think of, if someone was having a child. And so we had this very rich culture that was created at MK. And the real thought was if we could create another space that we could work in and continue on with this culture and then begin to invite others in, being the next wave of culinarians and or servers, that could then become infectious enough where people would want to be in the same room with us 365 days a year.
Yeah.
Right. And that was the original thought in terms of the restaurant, that we'll just treat each other so well that will become the culture for the restaurant. And then we will call said culture hospitality at its highest form. And then we'll put some food behind it and, you know, we'll just call it a restaurant.
Okay.
You know.
But when you talk about this and then when you execute it being full service,
yes,
dinner focused, you high overhead, high labor, high ingredient cost. What does that mean in terms of, because part of that is thinking about healthcare, thinking about benefits for employees, living wage, versus keeping the lights on, getting butts in seats. How did you kind of, with that being built in, because I think for a lot of restaurant owners, they're struggling with that kind of stuff now. It's not legislated. The onus is on the business, but so it's kind of, it falls to them. And a lot of times that they say, well, you know, when we become profitable, then we can start to talk about adding. So how did you kind of approach that? What were some of your goals in terms of well-being of staff from the beginning? And how did you execute that?
So one of the great things that, one of the many things we were taught at MK was ownership. Mm. And so when you enter anything with a sense of ownership, it's unlike anything else that you partake in.
Meaning ownership over what you're working on or just in general, not necessarily like I own this restaurant.
Like buy-in.
Okay.
So if we took away ownership and just use the term buy-in, right? Because buy is the key factor.
Yeah.
You have to physically, right, take something of value and invest into said idea. And so that was a practice at MK. You didn't get anything without buy-in. You didn't get a raise. You didn't get any kind of rewards, any kind of affirmation unless there was buy-in, because there was an investment made in you. And then the expectation was from ownership, a return on said investment.
Right.
So if you were going to be the lead line cook, then the expectation was is not only were you going to be able to cook very well, but you needed to display some level of leadership. And then you would be rewarded with a salary or a benefit package that compensated you for the energy that you put in.
Right.
And the interesting thing is you were never given the pay before the work, as opposed to how things are done in restaurants now. Like kids come in, they want like really high salary to catch up with the job.
Right.
And it's like,
no, you got to prove yourself.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so, so now we have this group of people who believe in this whole concept of buy-in. And so as we engaged our group, it sounded very similar to, look, we're not going to be able to give you like the raise that you would have gotten at your other job. You're going to have to forego that raise for a year. And if we can make this work in a year, then we'll pay you that raise plus.
Well, yeah.
But that's what it's going to take for us to do what we need to do, because we want to start with very, very minimal overhead. And everyone that signed up, for maybe the exception of one person who was just underpaid, that's how everybody came into it. And the roles in new restaurants are very unique to the roles anywhere else, because mm-hmm. you can do anything in a restaurant as a cook and or a chef, from planning a menu to legitimately mopping a bathroom in the middle of service.
Yeah.
And that is also part of the buy-in, understanding that whatever your role is on paper may not be your role throughout the course of a day.
Right.
And fortunately, we groomed enough people early on, right, before this concept was really in ideal mode, that people have come together and started us off with a really, really grand opening. And, you know, I will add that this is the first time in my career that every single shift I engage with guests, someone tells me, thank you for opening that restaurant.
That's beautiful.
That's
so
great.
But it's also a testament to you as a leader and a mentor that all of these people were willing to forego that additional money, that they believed in you and believed in your vision to come and work with you. And then like coming back to the guests thanking you, you built a reputation, and you are truly one of the most celebrated chefs in Chicago, and you could have opened anywhere you wanted. Why did you choose to open Virtue in Hyde Park?
Well, a friend approached me with the opportunity, and the opportunity wasn't carved out the way that it became. And so we had to set really the precedent on what the place was, and what it could become. And Hyde Park happens to be one of the most diverse spaces in Chicago in terms of economic diversity,
yeah,
in terms of sexuality, in terms of
race,
academics, race, and culture.
Absolutely.
And so why not, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
if you've got that much going on, right?
It kind of told you to open there.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Like that sounds like it makes sense. One of the unique things about Hyde Park, however, is it's in the city, but it acts like a suburb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it comes off a little bit like a suburb.
And it was once a suburb.
I did not realize
back
that.
In the day before it got incorporated into Chicago proper. It was separated, and it became, I don't know what year it was, but it became incorporated into Chicago. I mean, there's a lot of part. I mean, Uptown was like that. Lakeview was like that. As you got out from the city center, they were technically like small communities and eventually became part of Chicago.
Ari always likes to throw off his little journalism
chops. I know,
chops,
he does. You know?
I'm look a real him, researcher.
Look how smug he is over there, but it's okay. Well-deserved.
Thanks.
Can we get back? I'm dying because when you talk about Southern food, it makes the room fill with sparks. It's amazing. And when I asked you to describe the cuisine, you took this big sigh and you said, I want to be clear. The food is about the experience of Southern cooking. Can you explain what that means?
Yes.
And your journey into and through Southern cuisine?
Oh boy.
Maybe so we need like, maybe here we go, folks. Yeah, we stay here all night. Maybe.
Could be. Yeah. It's a long day because it's early.
So I'll give the abbreviated version. First, I think it begs to answer the question, so why Southern food? And I'm African American. And for a lot of African American chefs, Southern and or soul food feel a little bit too casual. And if casual is not the best word, it feels very, very familiar.
You're saying casual in presentation.
No, I mean casual as in rigor.
Okay.
So part of what chefs feed off of, A, is adrenaline.
Yeah.
And a lot of it. And the idea of tearing something up and reconstructing it. And so it's like the dirtier the vegetable, the more we want to eat it. The uglier the item, the more we want to figure out like what, you know, how to make this become something that's attractive. The tougher the cut of meat, right? The more we want to identify how we can get this into something that feels luxury and luscious.
Yeah.
And so now you have this food group that it's kind of like, you know, that was the food my grandmother cooked, you know, like, okay. Yeah, I mean, like that was really good. But and while that is happening in your brain, then there's this whole other space of what you're being mentally fed, that French cuisine is haute cuisine. Yeah. It is right. It's the foundation and the pinnacle of all food. And then we fast forward and we get Italian, which comes on much, much later. But now pasta could be the basis of working with flour and dough. And okay, there's enough Italian and people still kind of don't understand whether it's pasta or something else.
Yeah.
So then we breach, right, the universe, and we decide that we're going to go to Asia, and we get these funky fish sauces and umami flavors from miso and things like that. And so why in the world do I just want to go out in the backyard and pick collard greens?
Journey further and further away.
Right. Yeah.
As opposed to just coming home.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I took a short trip to Nashville. And I kind of got this thing about plantations, you know, being a black guy. And so I don't generally visit
plantations. Really? I can't understand why.
Yeah. You know, it's
seems
a little
like
odd.
It's such a happy place.
Yeah. And so there was a particular plantation that I sought out.
And when was this, would you say, in your chef journey?
Oh, man, maybe about 5 years ago.
All right.
And so my family and I are in Nashville, and we go on this plantation visit, and come to find out that it was Belle Mead. And Belle Mead was the home of thoroughbreds in our country. So now I'm intrigued because I'm intrigued with history. And I find out all this wonderful information about how everything I just thought, because I didn't do any I didn't do any real research about thoroughbreds. And I thought, like so many people who are comfortable with not doing any research on thoroughbreds, that Kentucky, because that's where the Derby is, like, duh, that makes sense. That's where thoroughbreds would have been raised and reared, right? Because that's where we identify a bunch of horses in our country and this really important race that kind of happens and this whole cultural thing, right? Yeah. But Belle Mead was the place that reared thoroughbreds for the world. And so it was the hub of Nashville. We would call it the capital today, and everything ran through Belle Mead. And then when you identify what slavery did to our country and what the primary work was, cotton comes to mind, sugar and sugarcane come to mind, tobacco come to mind, a lot of things come to mind. Raising thoroughbreds is nowhere near, right, the ideas that we could have. And so we'd venture to say that the labor was quite different, because if you think about what it takes to take care of an animal versus laboring in a field for an entire day, it's just a different work. And so I was walking through this plantation, and I landed in their smokehouse, and it is humongous. And all of a sudden I went into total chef mode, and I started thinking, wow, like just imagining how many hogs did they have to fill the smokehouse? And then how many people, like how many laborers did it take to slaughter those hogs, feed those hogs, groom those hogs? And how many people did it take to just create kinder for the flames, right? To chop down trees, dry out that wood, and create smoke. And then who was the person? Like who was the one that went in and touched the hams and said, no, this side of the room is warmer. That side of the room is more damp. We're probably gonna have to rotate all these hams, right? So that we get the right combination. And then aha, I had a moment. And I was like, they were making prosciutto.
I was just gonna say.
Why in the hell have I never had Southern prosciutto?
Oh my God.
Amen. And why haven't my people been celebrating all these hams? Why haven't we all been having it? Right?
Yeah.
Like, why are we still why is still so much of it imported?
Yes. And so then I thought about my family, my own family, and I thought about the idea that it would be easier to serve my mother prosciutto than Southern ham that had been cured, manufactured, processed the same exact way. Because as soon as I say South, what comes to her mind is cherries, soak this ham, get all the salt out of it, and then bake the hell out of it, even though the texture is already perfect. And now we got ham, right? And it's like, you know, we could actually just take that same ham, right, and clean it off and then put it on a slicer and slice it really, really thin and get bread, and you really don't need to do anything to it. And that was what was the birth of the idea as a culinary change or a culinary shift in my head to engaging, embracing, and highlighting what the South had to offer. And then that took me immediately into this space of, well, I can't do soul food. I can cook soul food to help people have an entry to what it is I'm about to do.
Yeah.
But it needs to land. Yes.
Well, I was gonna. So what? So let's back up a second.
Uh huh.
What's the difference between soul food and Southern food for people who don't know, who are listening?
If we categorized or separated soul food from Southern food, soul food would best be described as the best of country and or scrap cookery.
Right.
And so it's not the refined version of the greater sum. And the greater sum would be Southern cooking, and then soul food would be a denominator. It doesn't make it less than. It has its own space.
Right.
Like the rich techniques that were applied and the end result of what you get in soul cooking really is the best of what you could do with said ingredients.
Right.
But as a chef, I have a hard time limiting myself to cooking just the intestines of the pig.
Yeah.
When I know a little further up the animal are the chops.
Right.
And, you know, if we got into anatomy, and I won't geek out here, but the ribs are also connected to the loin, which makes a rib chop. So I'd eaten ribs my whole life, right? I mean, like had an abundant access to ribs, but where the hell was the loin?
Right.
Right. I mean, it's delicious. Yeah. I don't care if you want to call it the new white meat, or if you want to argue about heritage or heirloom pigs where the meat's actually darker and much more marbled. At the end of the day, where has the loin been at my dinner table? And so this set me on fire on the inside because I there was this discovery that I had and I needed to share with people because I don't need to cut the pork chop like really, really thin, quarter inch, and make sure that everybody at the table has something to eat. I'm not in that space
right
currently.
Do Did you feel like when you had that discovery, did you feel like look back and think like I was cheated? Like I didn't get everything that I could have gotten out of that pig, like throughout life. And do you feel like that's something that's kind of like the, that you wanted to introduce to people and say, you know, something like you don't have to just eat this. You get all of it.
So cheat is not a good word because no, I did not feel cheated because I have some super nostalgic memories around that quarter inch pork chop that would get fried and then smothered
yes,
in gravy
yes,
that
please.
Had onions in it
yeah.
that would get served atop of rice that was fluffy and airy and delicious. And I've yet to learn how to cook rice as well as my family cooks polished rice.
Are they holding out on you?
They're not. It's just I don't spend that much time practicing that particular skill.
That's fair.
And if I chose a rice, I would probably pick unpolished rice, which would be from the strand of Carolina gold rice. And
which you serve with the catfish, which is heavenly.
Thank you. We like to think about heaven and food. And so, or angelic. Yeah. But either way.
I like angelic more.
Fine.
I don't feel cheated because I had such a rich experience in that space. But I do feel when I think about it that there needs to be an evolution. There needs to be an opportunity to evolve for many reasons. And one of the reasons is as people share these nostalgic spaces around food, whether it be the ice cream truck that went down your block when you were a kid that you chased or jumped on the back of.
You just totally sent me right back to my little neighborhood before we moved. When I was like 5 years old. That image just popped into my head.
And you still hear the music, right?
100%.
Like when you hear that music, it means something. But the ice cream was never really that great.
Right. What was your go-to ice cream flavor as a quick tangent?
I have always been a vanilla guy. I've never been a chocolate guy. And the truth is, you know, because it felt like luxury, I was really trying to work everybody in my family to get enough quarters and or dollars so that I could get a banana split. Because that made me like, because you got the really
it
big,
is.
Long, like, you
and
know,
you got
to
nice,
pick all
the
toppings.
That's luxury,
yeah.
man.
That is luxury.
Yeah.
That's luxury.
Yeah. So I was trying to prove really early on that like, I was kind of like, baller as a kid.
Yeah, totally.
Like you're sitting there, you know, arguing over your little ice cream cone. And,
you're
you
like,
know,
I'll be amassing quarters
yeah,
for my
yeah.
banana split.
You know, I had like full service. I had my own little, you know, container that my ice cream went in and I had my little plastic spoon. And like you could fuss over your little cone.
Do you know what I like that you brought up though about soul food and about being a chef, the parallels of taking something and sort of almost treating it like a puzzle, like how do we achieve this luxurious texture or how do we get the most out of this? So in a way, you're kind of coming, you come home to the notion of soul food in how you approach an ingredient as a chef, right? That it sort of, to me, takes, it's that same muscle that you're working in a way.
Yes, I would agree. And you know, so if we described soul food as the best of scrap cookery, right, or this rustic form that we add this refined shape to, right, then the idea also works in that same space. So we've gotten away from eating in a way that is very natural and a lot healthier and organic. And now we've taken said food source, being soul food, and said that it's heavy, it's overly rich, it's uninviting. You know, it should only be eaten at certain times.
Right.
But the truth is the creators of soul food didn't eat nearly as much of the food that we eat today with all this access that we have mm-hmm. on a day-to-day basis, right? I mean, African Americans worked from sunup to sundown, and then they ate whatever the largest portion of their meal would be.
Yeah.
During the day on the fields, it's no way you could stand out in unshaded land and work to your capacity. And you were expected to work at full capacity, right? After eating four pork chops.
Yeah.
Like that's not a thing,
you're like,
right?
I'm gonna go lie down and take a nap. That wasn't happening.
No, it was not happening. And so there are all these fallacies around the food itself. That's first. But I've taken the approach. I mean, there are a lot of chefs that are very interested in the idea of soul food and really telling that story. And I think for the first time in my career, I'm seeing the story and hearing the story told at a really qualitative, with a really qualitative energy. Mm-hmm. But then there's a piece that's left out. The other food we were cooking, because we cooked all the food. Like, Africans were the labor force for the country.
Yeah.
From the tip of Texas to the White House. Mm-hmm. We cooked everything. The railroad porters, we were the chefs. Mm-hmm. And so what were we cooking for everyone else? We weren't just cooking soul food. We cooked everything.
Everything. Yeah.
Right. And that everything is Southern food. And it is really the true form of American cooking.
Yeah.
Because it encompasses all of the things and all of the techniques that we inherited in this country by way of France, by way of Spain owning New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not by mistake that paella and jambalaya feel so similar. And it's not by mistake that jollof feels so similar to those other two named items that are rice dishes with protein in them. And it's because of all these rich influences that settled in these areas. And then there's one other component, and that's why this thing becomes so complicated, and that's why I have to use the canvas of Southern. Because we call barbecue, barbecue, but we don't call it soul food, and we don't call it Southern. Now, we know that, you know, well, in my groups, Black folks can really cook some ribs. I'm just saying, for the record. there is a barbecue circuit.
Yeah.
Where people compete, and then their backyards that will be filled with smoke for the 4th of July. And people will share bones and stories like people have shared the best of their wares throughout history. And it's a thing. And it's a thing to be able to argue that my sauce is, right? And I rub these ribs with. And we cook these ribs this, right? And that's a space.
Yeah.
But why don't we call ribs soul food?
Right.
Because they're barbecue. And so the only time we argue about titles is when it's Southern. Because we don't understand Southern. We don't understand why they eat grits on one side of town and they eat rice on the other side of town.
Right.
And no one wants to delve back into that space. No one of color wants to delve back into that space because it's so dark.
Right.
And it's always overcast with the cloud of slavery. And so why don't we just talk about the energy, right? If we want to talk about food, we definitely have some work to do as we talk about labor,
right?
And construct and racism and so many other things. But that's not my battle. My battle as a chef is to tell the story about a rich culture and the heritage that I've inherited, right, by way of food, and to bring that together in a way that feels good to people and allows them to converse and allows them to come together.
So one of the things you were talking about, how slaves were the cooks, the chefs of the country, they were cooking everything. And one of the things that in this day and age where it's for years, the most quote unquote celebrated chefs were white men. Then there was the argument of why aren't there more women in the kitchen?
Yes.
As one of Chicago's best chefs, period.
Thank you.
Color aside. Why do you think that there aren't more people of color leading kitchens, not only in Chicago, but around the country? Why? How do we change that?
I think it's being changed. And I think it's being changed because optics change how people view the world. We live with our eyes. We just do. And so if you turn on the news and you solely base your life off of what is being reported, then you believe the hype around Chicago being the most dangerous city in the country.
Right.
Right.
If you...
It has just that one dimension.
That is it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then if you read the stats, you quickly find out that Chicago may not even be in the top 10.
Right.
It is definitely not number one.
No. Baltimore, Detroit, et cetera.
Exactly. and St. Louis. If I'm not mistaken, St. Louis is number one.
Wow.
And so, and I've got nothing against St. Louis, but the data is the data, right? Numbers don't lie. And so then if you think about who tells the story, how we tell the story, how the story has been interpreted, then you've got another set of factors. And so the answer that you're looking for is African-Americans for many, many years have substituted the word servitude for service. And service is a very rich, rewarding process. To be able to give to someone of your labor and of your time in a way where it's received and appreciated and celebrated is special. If it isn't special, then why are artists who they are? And why do we call culinary arts culinary arts? And why is the office of politics considered public servants? They're not considered public servitude,
right?
And so we have so many categories where people go after the same process, right? The idea of being able to take care of people, right? Doctors, attorneys, they all provide a service, not a servitude.
Right.
And so it gets confused with one of the largest growing sectors in our country, right? Being the hospitality community. And I think that's what's happening as we start to explore what is soul food? What is Southern? Why do you cook soul food? Why do you cook Southern? Why didn't you just decide to do this versus that? And as African-American chefs are featured and begin to find their voice, I think we will see the tide change very, very quickly.
And I think the last time we spoke, you had about around 30 staff, a little over?
No. I think it's about 30.
About 30.
Yeah.
And I think 95% of them are from the South Side.
It may be a little less, you know, it fluctuates because staff and restaurant changes fast.
Yes.
But we're fortunate because people are moving closer to our restaurant at a very rapid pace. This is the first time I've ever seen young culinarians and on front of the house team members move to become closer to the restaurant. Everybody, as I was going through the ranks, tried to live as far from work as they possibly could because you didn't want to be called upon or run into on a day when the restaurant was in need. And these days people are like, no. And I didn't realize this, but one of our team members pointed this out in an interview, that this is the first restaurant that we've worked in where people come to work on their days off. Like we used to incentivize
to
at
eat,
MK.
You mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Ooh,
to eat,
wow.
To sit at the bar, to
That's
drink
huge.
Through the cocktails, to drink through the wine, the wines by the glass. They're in the restaurant.
Right.
It's almost a distraction. So we have to really work hard at trying to create balance there. But think about that for a second,
yeah.
Right? Like you've been in a place for 40 plus hours that week. You've got family and you spend a portion of your day working through your errands and your obligations. You spend a portion of your day trying to catch up with family members and friends. And then the last part of your day, your unwind is in the same place you've been wound up in all week.
Yeah.
And you feel like, well, if this place is so great for everybody else, then it's got to be a little great for me, right?
Right, yeah.
So you're sparking that same passion that was sparked in you at MK in this group of people who will hopefully, some of whom will be the executive chef owners of places maybe in 10 years that will be, you know, and so that optics, like you said.
And or operators.
Operator, right.
You know, and or consultants.
Yeah.
We want people to impact change and positive change.
Yeah.
And we want to employ people or give them permission to go out and create leadership. You know, Ari brought up the fact that, you know, my work is a testament to my leadership. But the truth is I don't see it that way. And I smile and get a little giddy. And people think that I'm like smiling because of the compliment. But it's because I don't focus so much on the aspect of leadership. I see myself as a misfit most days. and the truth is I know how many obstacles that I've overcome and how many of them I keep tripping over. I think what has happened and what happens in culture is you create space for people to grow and develop, which is unique to training people.
Right.
And I think in most business sectors, we train. But developmental processes are much longer. It's a much larger investment. But what it produces, bar none, is light years ahead of training. And it shows up not just in your workplace or in your career, but it shows up in all facets of your life. And so I couldn't have ever imagined that I would be in a restaurant where someone taught me this idea of buy-in or ownership, and that we would all be growing together from the youngest person in the room to the oldest person on the roster. And that's what growth does. It does, like, because growth doesn't have an age limit, right? And so a lot of hierarchy would have you believe, right, that I am here, I am accomplished, and you need to get where I'm at. But culture scratches against that, because it doesn't matter how far ahead of me you are in one area. You still have weaknesses just like I do, and you still have shortcomings just like I do. So even though you're way ahead in this area, you still find time to share space with me, because there's a benefit, right, to learning how I do X, because I'm much further ahead of you in this lane.
Yeah.
And there's a coming together that creates this force called team. And it's really an amazing place. So even though I may be the lead today, I could be the last guy on the roster tomorrow. I could be supporting someone else's lead. And I love the idea that I don't always have to carry the burden every single day.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely
great.
So we are.
So before we wrap it up, we're gonna end with a kind of a rapid fire round. First thing that comes to your mind, don't think too heavily on it.
No wrong answers.
No wrong answers, quick answers, et cetera. This is the fun, lighthearted piece of it. So what would you be doing if you were not a chef?
If I was not a chef, I would be heavily entrenched in real estate.
Okay. What movie will you always watch if you come across it flipping through channels?
Purple Rain.
What is your last request meal? No limitations.
It would be seafood. Who knows?
What characteristic do you admire most in a person?
What characters? Loyalty. Someone who I can trust. And someone that can display a high level of vulnerability.
What do you like least in a person?
Liars. People who are uncommitted. And people that are ego driven.
What's the last book you read?
Last book I began to read was
still counts.
Frederick Douglass's autobiography. Wow. And I have just picked up Common's Let Love Have the Last Word that I am thumbing through, and I am probably going to listen to both of those books.
Okay. Do you have a motto? If so, what is it?
That is the one thing that stumps me. I don't.
It's okay if you don't.
I'll come back to that one quickly.
And what's your favorite curse word?
Fuck.
Oh, it's the best.
It's an F-bomb.
It's a good one. So, Eric, thank you beyond for coming in and joining us in the studio today. Maggie and I both have mad respect for you. We both have interviewed you in the past. And
I still want to learn how to make the catfish.
Thank you.
And I want to come back in and eat more scallops and fried green tomatoes with shrimp, because that is delicious.
Thank you.
So now, before we leave, as we do every week, we are coming to the portion called Sip This, where Maggie and I bring in something different every week. Could be any form of beverage. We both write about food and beverages. We both get sent a number of things. We pick things up at stores, and sometimes we know what they are, sometimes we don't. And this is when we decide if we're going to like something or not. So Maggie, why don't you tell us what we're having today?
So I'm responsible for this week's Sip This. This is a series of tiny bottles of mead that I got from Trazo Meadery, which is a little meadery based out of Adams, Tennessee. It's family owned and operated by David Becky and Travis Powell. Travis tells me they specialize in making the finest show mead. I don't know what show mead is.
Well, why don't you talk about what is mead?
Mead is created by fermenting honey. The process is similar to winemaking, except that the sugar that feeds the yeast comes from honey instead of grapes. It's fermented with three basic ingredients, honey, yeast, and water. These guys are using, I think it's water from limestone, like it, that they get nearby. It could be the world's oldest alcoholic beverage.
I was just going to say it is. It predates pretty much everything else. And I think there is evidence of mead being drunk in Egypt, perhaps. And, you know, when
Egypt, Central Africa, I think it was on Chinese pottery from 7000 BC evidence. So it's old.
It's what the colonials drank when they came over. Initially.
So this, we have a series of, I think the main way you create distinction in flavor is based on what the bees are eating. So we have, I think, wildflower, avocado, pretty much anything that has a blossom.
Wildflower on Jamaican rum barrel. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, they've aged some of it. And so, but yeah, so I think aside from aging, the main way you vary the flavor is depending on what the honeybee is eating, which is nectar and pollen.
Yeah.
So, all right.
What do you want to, Eric, what do you want to taste?
I think wildflower on the bourbon barrel.
Go for it.
I think they might have won an award for that, but I can't.
And I'm going to open up the wildflower on Jamaican rum barrel.
Mm-hmm. I kind of want the avocado. Is it?
Yeah, I was going to say, I hope you pick it. It's also a really pretty color, that avocado.
It is. It's beautiful.
You would think it's green, but it's kind of
And these have a range. They go from kind of almost clear. The avocado is this deep amber color. Good. What are our thoughts?
Okay, I've got the wildflower on Jamaican rum barrel.
Whoa.
Wow. That's delicious. I mean, it tastes like a really fantastic after dinner drink, but without that cloying sweetness. It has a hint of it.
The avocado is almost like apple-y. Yeah, but it's a little woody and dry. It's delicious. I'm like kind of loving this. All right, I'm going for the wildflower 180.
Eric, what do you think about the bourbon barrel one?
Whoa.
I think I would expect it's a lot softer.
That's a good yeah.
Than I expected. I was expecting more alcohol. When I hear bourbon, I'm expecting a little bit of a kick.
But I think that one does if you taste that in comparison to the rum barrel one.
Is this the bourbon? Yeah.
So our wonderful producer Ernest here at Mess Marketing. he opened up the wildflower 180 and his eyes almost bugged out of his head.
Yeah, they did. Oh, the bourbon, it almost just like adds a rounder kind of caramely than like you the kick of booziness. The booziest one I've had is that wildflower 180.
Ooh, I like that.
I don't know what the difference is that makes it.
It's interesting though. It's like as it's derived from honey, there is that sweetness to it. But again, it's hard to...
We forgot the mesquite.
Oh yeah, that's the interesting one where it's like, we don't know where the mesquite flavor comes from because obviously bees are not pollinating wood piles, or
Chef,
are they?
Chef, do you think this has a place, mead has a place on the beverage menu at Virtue?
I think this mead would be phenomenal as a pre-dinner drink.
I
think it would be an excellent starter.
The meat plate... With that beautiful ribbony ham, the pepper jelly, the head cheese, sip a little mead with that. I am in heaven. And with the pickled peppers. Oh, yes. Loving that idea, actually.
Okay.
Aperitif. So we're thinking aperitif.
I think it could be both beginning or ending. I think that would be great.
Did you hate the avocado over there?
No. Yeah. the avocado one, it was not good at all.
It's drier and a little funkier. I liked that one. I thought it was interesting.
So I don't like the ones that, saying I don't like them is not a good word. I'm not as fond of
so
the
diplomatic.
Ones that are lighter. Well, because I actually like them all. I think they
I
all have
too.
Place.
Yeah.
And I'm always intrigued by informing my palate. So I think they all have place. But if I pick two, it would definitely be the ones that lean closer to bourbon and for obvious reasons. But I also like the complexity of the wood versus the subtleties of the honey and then the light acidic profile of the mead.
I know. I like that we're getting flavors. Yeah. And some are drier. I like that it kind of is like drinking wine more than I expected.
Yeah.
It has more of a range. And
I think there's a misconception. I think people think it's more like beer, but it really is more like wine.
I agree.
Yeah.
I enjoyed them more than I was expecting.
Same.
Yay.
That was a fun little experiment. We had 6 different flavors and good. Cool. Well, Eric, thank you for participating in Sip This with us.
No problem.
And thank you for participating in Overserved. I feel like if we keep drinking those meads, we're going to be overserved. That said, Maggie, great spending another week with you.
You too. And Eric, I just want to say we're really lucky to have you in Chicago. We're grateful.
Amen.
Yeah. Chicago's lucky to have you. Thank you so much.
So everybody, thank you for once again tuning into Overserved. Check us out again next time when we come back to you discussing all things culinary in Chicago and beyond. And we look forward to having you back with us on the next episode of Overserved.